all said I'm in a straight twixt two. He said, I don't know what I want, but he said, I know what I prefer. But he said, to live is Christ, to die is gain. He said, now, you can't lose. If I stay here and live, it's Christ. If I don't stay here but die, it's gain. He said, look at that and realize that to stay here is Christ. That's good. But to die is gain. He said, that's good. But then he goes on to say, I'm in a straight fix too, having a desire to depart. He said, I lean toward leaving. I lean toward going to heaven. He said, now, Christ, to live is Christ, to die is gain. I'm torn between which I'd rather do. But he said, I sort of lean toward going to heaven. And then he said, it's just far better. Nevertheless, to abide in the flesh is more needful for you. Paul said, you need me. That's almost a conceited statement, isn't it? Sounds almost egotistical, doesn't it? Paul said, you need me. He said, I'm not through with you yet, and you need me a while longer. And having this confidence, I know that I shall abide and continue with you all for your furtherance and joy of faith, that your rejoicing may be more abundant in Jesus Christ for me at my coming to you again. Paul said, to live is Christ, that's good. To die is gain, that's better. He said, I don't know which one I want to do, but he said, it's far better for me if I die. But he said, it's better for you if I stay. He said, I know I'm going to stay a while longer because two reasons. He said, first, well, the furtherance, for your furtherance. That word furtherance is interesting. It is a word that has, it's a word that means to progress by cutting. To progress by cutting. Like the old pioneers that would just cut out the trees and cut out the weeds and not easy progress, but pioneer of progress. He said, first he said, you need me here. First, he said, for your furtherance. And then he said, and joy of faith that your rejoicing may be more abundant. Paul said the two reasons why you need me here. He said in the first place to keep on cutting out the underbrush and for the progress, the old hard pioneer progress of your faith. And then he said, second, to keep you happy, to make you happier, have you joy fuller. And he said have your rejoicing more abundant. Now Paul said, that's why I'm here. Let me review now just a minute and I'll get the message. Paul said, I live, it's Christ. That's good. I die, it's gain. That's better. Now he said, I'm in a strait. I said, knowing which I prefer, but he said, it's far better for me if I die. But he said, I'm going to hang around here. I know I am because it's better for you if I hang around here. And he said, the reason it's better for you is I got some underbrush to clear out yet. I got some pioneer work to do yet. I got to further it for your furtherance in the gospel. And then he said, you're not as happy as I want you to be. He said, I believe I'm going to have to stay around here now to make you happier and get your joy fuller and your rejoicing more abundant. Now, tonight, I don't know why I'm preaching this message. I don't know. I have no premonition that I'm going to die. The wicked never die young, and I'll live a long time.
You'll live forever.
But focus the idea. Why? But I don't have any premonition that I'm going to get bad sick or anything. I have none like that. But here it is. Here's the message, and this is what I'm supposed to say. So I say it. When I was 7 years old, I had a hard case of the measles. Now, back in those days, you didn't have any antibiotics. And measles was, and even said, by the way, parents, take good care of your kids when they get the measles. It so many after effects and lingering illnesses and associated illnesses that can come. So take care of your kid. But in those days, no penicillin, no miracle drugs, no antibiotics, and so it was rather serious. And so when I had a hard case, I was 7 years old, and we were very poor. We couldn't even afford to go to the doctor, and I couldn't afford any medicine. We lived in one room, just one little room. My mother, my dad, my sister, and me. One room. In that room Well, it was our kitchen, our dining room, our bedroom, and I can't explain the other parts of the house and what we did, but there were other, anyway. I got sick with the measles, and I got bad sick. And I can recall my mother sitting beside my bed all night long. And I can recall my mother praying out loud for me while I was lying there with the measles. And then she picked me up in her arms and prayed for me. And I can remember it just like it was yesterday. I said, Mother or Mommy, I feel like I'm going up in the air to be with Jesus. And my mother became frantic. She began to scream. She called for help. She called the neighbors. She got beside herself. And, of course, I didn't know why. She didn't tell me why until I was much older. But years before, my mother's second child, Hazel, had the measles. And Hazel got over the measles, they thought, and then she had a relapse of them. And they, all of a sudden, Mother picked her up. And Hazel said, Mommy, I feel like I'm going up in the air to be with Jesus. And she did. And my mother and dad buried their second 7-year-old child, the first two children, age of 7. You can imagine how then my mother felt when I, with the same disease, made the same statement. I've often wondered why Hazel was taken and I was left. Why did God spare me? I was a paratrooper in World War II. I was in infantry. One day we were taking a 26-mile hike. We're exactly halfway through, and my feet about to kill me. I was out of water. My canteen was empty. It was in the heat of the summer in Texas, and in what used to call South Camp Hood, Texas. I was about to die. A jeep pulled up. We were taking a ten-minute break. We used to call them that, take a break. And so we're taking a 10-minute break. A jeep pulled up. Some officers got out. And while we were sitting there beside the road in a ditch, these officers said, Men, we have a special group that we'd like to have volunteers. Anybody here would like to volunteer? And I didn't know what the group was. I said, I'd like to volunteer for it because I don't want to be in the infantry. And they said, the paratroopers is the group. I thought there could be nothing worse than the infantry. There is something worse than the infantry. 17 weeks later, I found myself 1,200 feet in the ground with nothing but a bunch of folded silk on my back in the door of an airplane with a sergeant making a rather emphatic suggestion that I leave the premises. In parachute training, back in the Eisen paratrooper, Stonewall Jackson was our leader. But you learn, everybody who was a trooper learned to pack parachutes. Now, later on, I was in the parachute maintenance company, which is we call the riggers, and that's the company that packs the chutes for all the division. But while you're in training, you pack the chute that you jump with. You learn to pack parachutes. And the first jump you make, ladies and gentlemen, is a parachute that you pack your little self. You talk about care and every little detail. I mean, never was a drape, accordion drape, ever packed with the care and concern that little parachute at once. Well, the first jump was on a Monday morning, and everything went well. Second jump, next day. See, you have 4 weeks of training. The first 3 weeks, the first week is nothing but calisthenics. I mean, nothing. You just calisthenics. But you had to do 90 push-ups with a full field pack on your back, and I often say, I can't do 9 now because there's full field pack on my front. But I, 90 push-ups, the full field pack on your back, and I had to do 25 one-handed push-ups. Now, you try that sometime. 25 one-handed push-ups. That's one a day for 25 days. And, 25 every day. And, you had to climb a 35-foot rope and reach up and touch the top and holler, hubba, hubba, and then climb down. And that was the first week. Nothing. Now, the second week, the morning was calisthenics again and running. Had run a mile the first day without stopping, and 2 miles the second day, and 3 the third without stopping, and 4 the fourth, and 5 the fifth, and 6 the sixth. Up to the 10th day, we had to run 10 miles without stopping. And much of that, all of the combat boots on, and much of it counting, hup, hoop, beep, four, hup, hoop, beep, four, hup, hoop, beep, four, as you ran. Now, the third week was the week that we worked calisthenics and then on the towers. We had a 300-foot tower. You've seen pictures of them in amusement parks where the big parachute is clipped on to a big frame at the top. Same thing. And they lift you 300 feet. You're in a harness here, and they lift that thing 300 feet, then unhook the clips up there. You think it's not dangerous. You think it's dangerous jumping. That guy unhooks those clips. Boy, now he has a dangerous job. Anyhow, they unhooked those clips, and we just fell 300 feet and had to guide ourselves away from the big tower in the middle. And then they had a little 34-foot tower, which was the scariest of all because you put your harness on and you jumped off without a parachute and dropped about 20 feet. And that let you know how the shock was of, I've seen people, no joke, I've seen people, when they open the parachute, I've seen the big wide, risers. Stay out of my preaching. And anyway, the straps across your shoulder. I've seen when you open, if it wasn't tight, the chute wasn't tight enough, I've seen those things just lift the flesh off, just like you'd roll carpet and just lift the flesh right off. A strip of flesh just about that wide, just strip right off your shoulder. And so we jumped off 34 times. Now, the fourth week was jump week. First day, first morning, we jumped. First jump was fine. Second, by the way, that afternoon, back to the hangar and packed our parachute for Tuesday. And I jumped on Tuesday. Everything was fine. And on Tuesday afternoon, we packed the parachute for Wednesday. And I jumped on Wednesday. Everything is fine. Now, on Thursday night, we jumped. That we packed the parachute on Wednesday afternoon. On Thursday night, we made a night jump. And then on Friday morning, we made our fifth jump. And you had to make 5 jumps, then you got your wings, and you were a paratrooper officially after 15 weeks of infantry training, and then 4 weeks of parachute training, got your wings. So I on my fifth jump, what you do when you jump out of an airplane is, if you're the first man, and I was, you stand, the sergeant, I won't go through all that count off and so forth like I'm before, but the sergeant says, stand in the door. And so you stand in the door and you put your hands like this, just outside the plane, the door of the plane like this. And you look toward the horizon. You never look down because if you do look down, you won't go down. And so you look toward the horizon. And so the sergeant says, ready, go. And so you jump out and you make a 45-degree angle like this to the left. Now, this is back in the days. We didn't have these quiet planes where there's no prop blast. We had what used to be a C-46, C-47. It's now a DC-3. And the prop, the electric fan on the front keeps the plane up in the air. Like Bill Harvey said one time in our airplane, said, stewardess, would you turn those fans off? It's cold in here. And Bill Harvey and I were in an airplane one time. We were in a storm. Oh, a storm. My soul. We did a DC-3, and that thing was shaking like a bottle of medicine. And boy, thing almost turned on. And so I was reading my Bible, and Bill was reading the magazine. And he looked over at me, and he said, chicken. But, and Bill never told more truth in his life as he got his Bible. But anyway, we stand the door, And the sergeant said, ready, go. So you turn 45 degrees to the left, and you put your arms around the your reserve parachute. Now, on the back, you have a big parachute about that high and about that wide, and it has a static line, a big belt-like thing that goes from the back of the chute, and you attach that to a cable that goes down to the middle of the plane. Now, you jump 15 feet out of the plane, that static line pulls to its full length, and the cable causes that static line to pull the back of your chute open. The back of your chute is just held on by string. And so when you jump out, that 15-foot line gets to its full length, then it pulls that top off the case of your parachute. It's also hooked to the top of the parachute, and it just pulls the parachute out just about like the parachute's all packed in there like that. And then when it gets out, pulls it like that until the air gets under it, and then the chute opens like that. And here I am, right down here. And we jump. So my fifth jump, I jump, and you count. You put your hand. You have a reserve chute here on the front. It's about a third as big as the one on your back, and it's a big puffy thing here. It looks like a. What does it look like? It looks like a reserve parachute. And so, it's on the front here. So you jump out, and you put your feet and legs together, and you bend your legs. Don't ever land with your legs stiff. You'll break a leg. And so you bend your legs slightly to the left, as you turn toward the left, and put your arms around the chute, put your chin down here, like this, and you start counting. Now I'm out of the plane now. I'm falling right now, and I count 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. And the chute is supposed to open after counting 3,000. If it doesn't open after counting 3,000, then the second chute has a ripcord. First chute has no ripcord. It's automatically pulled open by the cable in the plane hooked to the static line. So, then if you don't, after 3,000, if you look out and everybody else looks like they're going up, that means you're going down too fast. And so, you pull that rip cord and your reserve chute opens in front like this. On my fifth jump, about Friday morning, I jumped and said, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. I looked out. And looked like the rapture. We had 10,000 men jump that one day. They were all going up at me. I expected the Antichrist to be revealed any minute. And so, by the way, look, only 12 seconds. We jumped about that day, 800 feet. First day, 1,200 feet. But you fall 100 feet a second. Now you got 8 seconds. If you count 1,000, 2,000, that's a second. 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000. That's all you have to count. That's one reason why paratroopers can't count very high. We don't have to count very high. And I counted down about 5,000. And my chute wasn't open. What had happened was this. Instead of opening like this, coming up, it comes up like this, and the chute is like that. And the wind gets under it like this and opens it up. But my suspension lines, which look like shoelaces, they're sort of like big boot shoelaces. In fact, our paratroop boot laces were suspension lines. And it had gotten wrapped around the silk part. And because it was wrapped around the silk part, the air couldn't get up there because suspension line was keeping, called a streamer. Call it a streamer. The air came. Now usually when you die with a streamer, you die by landing on your feet because you have a little air there. It's not like your chute not opening. The chute doesn't open. You just flop, 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 flop. But if you chute open a streamer, you just go down too fast. That's all. And you die feet first, which is a much more comfortable way to go. And, So we jumped, and I jumped, and counted to 5,000, opened the reserve, and the reserve opened. Now, as soon as the reserve opened, the suspension lines got untangled, and they opened the main chute. Now, anybody knows anything about parachute troopers knows this, that it's almost sure death when two chutes are open. I got one chute open here. I wish it here. I got another chute open here. This is a reserve chute over here. It's much smaller. And now, and I'm down underneath there. See, I'm down here. I'm the microphone here, and here they are. Now, what happened was this. These chutes get together, and they collapse each other. And it's almost sure death when two chutes are open on one man. And down on the ground, they're watching me all the time. You see, in a paratroopers, you jump, and if your first chute opens, that's good. If it doesn't, you got a reserve. But if it doesn't, then there's a little red wagon down there at the bottom that transports you off after it scrapes you up. My first chute didn't open, then open, so I'm screaming. When I got down there, that wagon was already there waiting for me. You never saw such a disappointed driver in your life. He thought he had a customer. I was down there on the ground, and by the way, landed safely. Didn't get up for a while because I was too weak, but not a scratch. Why did God spare me? When I was a paratrooper, riggers in a parachute maintenance company, we'd go down to the hangar. A hangar is a room, about a fourth the size of this auditorium, maybe, and big long table across the thing, and each one of us had packed parachutes at a table. Now, there's a fellow named Alley from Ohio, a fellow named Collingsworth from Pennsylvania. Are you listening, young ladies? On either side of me. And Alley from Ohio over here. All of us 18 years old. I was in the middle, Collingsworth away. One day they came through and they said, "Men, we need one other man to jump with a certain division and a certain regiment. And who'll jump?" Well, I wanted to jump. We all wanted to jump every time we could. We're jump happy, crazy fools. And Collingsworth said, "Let me jump." Alley said, "I want to." I said, "Let me do it." And they just said, "Any, meeny, miny, mo," or just guessed at it. They just picked one out. And as fate would have it, they picked out Alley. And Collingsworth and I both were disgusted. We were there on a hot summer day, packing parachutes and no air conditioning and no air passing through there. We were just so hot. And so, Alley, boy, he was happy. He didn't have to work the rest of the day. All he had to do was go jump, have the day off. But something went wrong, and Alley was killed on that jump. I could have been in that parachute. Why did God spare me? When I was pastor in Garland, Texas, I was traveling from one Texas city to another to preach. On the way to the airport, I got in a traffic jam behind a wreck. And I was going to miss a plane. I was so upset, I'll miss my plane and won't get to preach tonight. And finally, I got out of the traffic jam and broke all the speed limit, going to the airport. Got there, plane just taken off. Oh, I was exasperated. My soul. Oh, by the way, in Central Texas, that plane mysteriously crashed. And I had a reservation on that plane. Why did God spare me? 16 years ago or so, Russell Anderson and I went to Japan. I preached in Tokyo 4 days, and Russell and I decided to fly to Hiroshima. One of the most eventful days of my life, flying to Hiroshima, the place that where the first atomic bomb was dropped. I saw people in Hiroshima. Listen, when was that bomb dropped? 1945. Okay, and I was there about 1967, and I guess, and now, I saw people that had not moved as much as a finger since 1945. 22 years. I saw one man right next door to the pastor's house. I didn't preach in Hiroshima, but the pastor of the First Baptist Church there wanted me to come to his house, And right next door, he took over to see a man. That man, since the bomb dropped about 20-some-odd years before, that man had moved nothing but his mouth and his eyelids. Nothing. I went to a hospital and saw dozens of people. In fact, the cab driver that drove me to the hospital didn't have one hair on his head, not one hair on his head. And I said, "Were you here when the bomb dropped?" And he said, "Yes, I was." And I said, "Did it affect you any?" He said, "Yes, lost all my hair." And I said, "Well, it must have had some fallout, came to the Chicago area, because I lost mine too." But he said, "No." He said, that morning I woke up with a big bushy head of hair. He said, "It just completely removed all of my hair just like that." And he said, "I have not had the hair on my head since." Another cab driver that drove us to the Peace Park, where you got the big museum there, about the center where the bomb dropped, he said he went to school that morning as a child. And he said that the bomb dropped while he was on his way to school, and not a single person of his family has ever heard from since. And he was left as a little boy. No place to go, no home to go to, didn't know anybody, and folks dying with the thousands all around him. Anyway, we got back to Tokyo, and we're taking off from Tokyo to come back to Chicago. I bought a camera for one of the kids, I think for Cindy. And so I got to Tokyo Airport, and the official said, "You can't take a camera out of the country unless you're examined and inspected." So Russell didn't have a camera. I bought a camera, a little $10 camera. And so they put me in an office over there. And I couldn't understand what they were saying. And they were gibbering, jabbering in Japanese. And so I was sitting there waiting. And it got within 10 minutes of my flight takeoff. And Russell was already on the plane. And I sat in the office with him. And they weren't talking to me. It got about 2 minutes before my flight. And they were over there talking. And they're back. And I took my camera and ran. I escaped the office of the Japanese. I'm still wanted, I'm sure, in Japan. And so me and Bobby Knight. And anyway, I ran as fast as I could down the corridor, and they were chasing me, and I had a camera and a sack and my briefcase, and ran down the corridor. And as I got out the plane, they were just raising the steps. I jumped up on the step, and they closed the door behind the officials. You can check with Russell Anderson. I got on the plane. And they were beating on the door as we took off from the gate. It'd been awful if I'd missed that plane. Russell plane by himself. Okay, we took off. We flew to Anchorage, Alaska. just refueled. And then took off from Anchorage, flew to Chicago. We came down to Chicago, the big DC-8 plane, I think it was. And we came down to Chicago, got 300 feet from the ground, and all of a sudden the engines got more power and took off back up again. Now, I'm not very smart, but I know that's not normal. And then we started circling, and the pilot said, "Ladies and gentlemen, our landing gear will not come down. That's the wheels, folks. That's what you roll on the runway." So the pilot said, "We'll have to circle till we use up all of our gasoline." You've heard about that, right now. And so you'd be amazed how fast you can pray. We're up there, a lady right behind us. She looked, "See, what's wrong, man? I've never flown before." And I said, "The landing gears won't come down." She said, "Is that good or bad?" And Russell looked at me and said, "Brother Howes, you're sweating." And I said, "Well, it's time to sweat, Russ." He said, Paul said, "For me to live is Christ, to die is gain." I said, "Paul didn't have four kids to rear either." And I can still see him now, crawling down below the floor, working on those landing gears. Right beside where Russell and I were kneeling. And of course we landed safely, and I was not killed. I'm glad to announce that to you. Now, why did God spare me? I used to jog every night at home or on the road. One night I was jogging out in Munster. All of a sudden, a car came whizzing by me, and they called me some dirty names. And they drove around the block, and they came whizzing by me again. And as they drove by me, a bullet hit my feet. That's where I learned to dank. And the bullet hit my feet. I'll be honest with you, that's the last time I ever jogged. I haven't jogged the steps. Oh, I jogged 3 feet out here while I go in the alley, but I wonder why God spared me. I used to have a spot over here on Lake Michigan where I used to pray. I'd drive over there close to Whiting Park, and I'd drive over there, and that's where I'd pray. One day I was praying over there in that little spot to the side of Whiting Park, out in a very secluded spot. I finished praying, got in the car, and backed out. My car was facing the lake. It backed out and started going like that. I looked up and saw a man with a rifle, lift his rifle and point it right toward my head. And as I saw that, I swerved the car driving away, and the bullet came right by the car. And boy, I took off, swerving all the way. Say, why are you swerving? It's awful hard to see from the floorboard. I'm like that Japanese kamikaze pilot, you know. So, about what were you in the war? He said, what's your name? So, the name's Chow Main. He said, what were you in the war? So, it's a kamikaze pilot. Well, why aren't you dead then? He said, me chicken Chow Main. I'm chicken. But I wonder why did God spare me? I'm sure that while I've been talking tonight, sort of piddling around up here, really, I'm sure you've been thinking about some time in your life when you wondered if you were going to live or die. Was it a serious illness? I can recall when my mother thought I was going to die one night with strep throat. Back then, we had nothing for strep throat. And strep throat, ladies and gentlemen, was deadly. I'd say at least a third of the folks had got strep throat. But no miracle drugs, no antibiotics, no penicillin, no ampicillin. Nothing. It's like Maxine Jeffries. She was visiting the fellows, pretty sick. And he was going to have a biopsy the next day to check and see if he was malignant. And she looked up at him and she said, I just talked to the doctor. He said, you're going to have an autopsy tomorrow. And that's this one right back here. That's the one. And, but, was it you? Is he here, Maxine? I'm talking to you, Maxine. Is he here? Is that him back there? Oh, he's not here. Did he have a biopsy or an autopsy the next day? I expect he died of the heart attack and had an autopsy the next day. But, anyway, you're thinking about some time right now in your life. Was it a car accident? Somebody killed in the accident? Or did they say that you could have been killed? Or they look at the car and say, I wonder how anybody lived through that. I'm sure that most of you are thinking right now about some time in your life there's a close call. Why did God leave you here? Why did God leave me here? Tell you why God left me here. God left me here for you. Paul said to the Philippian people, he said, to live is Christ, to die is gain. He said, I have a strait betwixt two, having a desire to depart, which is far better. But he said, it is more needful for you that I remain. And he said, here's why. He said, I need to help you in the fervence of your Christian life, in the digging out of the underbrush and the pioneering and the growth in grace and the progress and the continued going forward. I need to dig out the underbrush and pioneer and take a knife and cut as I go. I've got to do that. And I want to say this tonight. And I'm not sure why I'm preaching this. I said I feel no premonition whatsoever. But Paul said, I'm left, and God spared me because, by the way, Paul could tell more times than I did tonight about when he had a good chance to die. And Paul said, no, I'm left for one reason, two reasons. One is, cutting your way forward. Now I'm going to say this, and I don't know why I'm saying it. Maybe I'm asking you to pray for me that I'll live a long time. Maybe I'm asking you to pray for my health. I don't know. But if I were to be killed in a plane crash tomorrow, you could fill this pulpit. There are many preachers that would fill this pulpit gracefully and graciously and do just as good a job as I do. You would not, you could replace my preaching, but the hardest thing you'd have to place would be my policing. My policing. I watch everything in this church and I keep my eye on all of it. I watch it carefully. I walk guard. Take, for example, I've been working with the schools this year. I'm talking about the high schools, junior high and grade school. And I believe we've formed a beautiful unit this year of the teachers. And I think we're a team. And I've been working for the first time. Now, we've made some progress. Now, we're not home yet. There's still some underbrush to be cut out. And Paul said, I'm left for that purpose. Then Paul said, I'm also left for your joy of faith, that your rejoicing may be more abundant. Paul said, I'm here to help you cut out the underbrush and to help you, to cut your way forward and help you grow in grace. And hey, I'm here, he said, to keep things going. But he said, also, I'm here that your joy might be greater and that your rejoicing might be more abundant. And that's one reason why I'm here. And I'll tell you a story that most of you have heard, but it illustrates best what I'm saying. 25 years ago, I was pastoring in Garland, Texas. Miller Road Baptist Church had an evangelist there named Tom Landers. Tom moved from Fort Worth, Texas and joined the Miller Road Baptist Church as an evangelist just to be under my ministry. And Tom and I, he was younger than I. Oh, I don't know, about the same age, I guess. Anyway, brilliant young man. Tom Landers preached a revival meeting over here at the First Southern Baptist Church on Hoffman Street in Hammond 25 years ago. He came back from Hammond. He said, Brother Hiles, he said, let me have lunch with you some days a week. And Tom and I had lunch at Harris's Restaurant in Garland, Texas. And we sat at the table, and Tom said, Brother Jack, he said, I want to ask you to do me a favor. And I said, what? He said, I want you to go to Hammond, Indiana. He said, they invite you up there, and I recommend it. I want you to go up there and preach just for 2 weeks, every morning, every night, twice on Sunday, for 2 weeks. I said, Tom, I don't even know where Hammond, Indiana is. I just knew that's where they made Hammond organs. And they don't make Hammond organs in Hammond, Indiana. Like one day, I stopped at Boulder, Colorado, and asked where Boulder Dam was. He said, it's in Arizona. But anyway, he said, Jack, he said, now you can identify with this. He said, those poor people up there in Hammond, Indiana, get up early in the morning when it's dark and below zero, snow everywhere. he said, Jack, nothing up there in color. It's all black and white all winter long. And he said, they go to those steel mills and work in those steel mills, those blast furnaces, all day. He said, they get off at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the wintertime and set them or so, and they get out and get in the car, and by the time they get in the car, it's dark already. He said, they go in, it's dark, they come out, it's dark, and the snow's on the ground. And he said, many of them live in apartment houses and he said, Brother Jack, he said, that's not the prettiest area in the world. Now, he may have told the truth many times in his life, but he never came as close to it as he did then. And he said, Brother Jack, he said, I think that your preaching would do more than anything I know to cheer those people. He said, you enjoy preaching and you have a lot of fun and tell some funny things. And he said, well, would you go for 2 weeks and just, I think Hammond, Indiana needs your personality. And I said, not me, buddy. I'm a Southerner. I had a place in those days where I want all Northerners to go. I won't tell you where it is, but the booger man lives there too. He said, Brother Jack, I wish you'd think about it. I didn't know then that I'd spend almost a quarter of a century up here. I'm saying that it's better for you that I stay. Because there's some cutting on. We're not through yet. I mean, this church has some more underbrush needs clearing out. And there's some more progress we got to make. And our schools are not ready for me to go yet. I hope that you who have been here for 24 years, I hope that you've gotten a little happier. I hope you've learned to rejoice a little more. I hope you, dear senior citizens that face the sunset years of your life, I hope that in the last 24 years, I hope you've forgotten your burdens a couple of times on Sunday, maybe once on Wednesday night. I hope maybe the corny attempt at humor and cutting up with a educable slow over here, I hope it's given you a few laughs. I hope you blind folks have had some little refuge for you to come, have your joy increase, and your rejoicing made more abundant. I hope you college students in the dorms, if out there six of you share a telephone booth, and 75,000 of you share a restroom, I hope maybe getting to hear Brother Hiles a couple of times, three times a week, maybe on chapel some, and our little trips I make out there occasionally, I hope it's made you joy a little fuller, rejoicing more. I hope you marriage students, you young women that used to share a house back home with a husband, and now you share an apartment with cockroaches. I hope that hope may be coming inside this auditorium. One lady said to me, she said, that's the happiest looking place I ever saw. That's one reason why. By the way, all this decor in this auditorium is my idea. Some of you fellows remember that Mr. Foltz, architect, he decided he wanted to paint this brown up here. Stain it. paint that yellow around there. I said, no, sir. He painted a bunch of it. I said, paint over it. Why? I said, I want it white and gold, all of it. He said, why? And I said, I want the most cheerful place in the city of Hammond right here inside this room. I mean, I want sunshine inside this room. I hope that you children, you folks who have grown up here, I hope Vacation Bible Schools brought a little more joy and zest to your life. I was out in California, Santa Maria, California, sitting right down here was Dave Bider, one of our young men, grew up in this church. Dave's married now. I guess he must be, 25 years old or so? He's sitting out here. Dave's in full-time work for the Lord now, and he's sitting out there, he and his lovely wife. And I used it as an illustration, Vacation Bible School. And I started singing. When my cup is all empty and dry, when my cup is all empty and dry, I find it so hard to play and to sing. Look down, old Dave was going. And all of a sudden I went, bah! I cup runneth over with joy, and I cup runneth over with... And old Dave was laughing. I started singing, resist Satan, he will flee, he cannot defeat you. When you quote the Bible, he will leave. Look down, big old tears in Dave Bider's eyes after the service. He said, preacher, I remember those times. I remember when I was a little boy sitting over in the beginning of the department. He said, the devil come out with that knife going to bust your balloon. Not this one, but one I had in my... And going to bust your balloon. And he said, I remember all of that. You know, I hope that maybe there are years of memories that you have, maybe because I came here 24 years ago. I hope the Bible is dearer. I hope that heaven is more real. I hope that Jesus is closer and the throne of grace is nearer and the Holy Spirit is more precious. I hope I performed the wedding ceremony the way you wanted it done and conducted the funerals the way you needed it done. I mean this. I always give it my best. Some of you like that gal. She and her husband are getting a divorce. They were there in the courtroom, and she said, and just to think, I gave you the 25 best years of my life. Her husband said, good night. Were those the best? Maybe you wonder. but I want to say this. I was thinking about this last night, Brother Larry. I preached yesterday, the commencement service for City Baptist High School. Seven graduates. Seven. Please. Dr. Claire? What did I call you Dr. Claire for? Brother Bob? I preached at Tennessee Temple University in the city auditorium to thousands of people. I dare say 750 graduates. And I preached a sermon that was a rerun. But yesterday morning, when I preached to our seven seniors over here, I prepared a message I'd never preached in my life before. You know why? Because I try to give you my best. Now, why has God left you? Because somebody needs you. Paul said, to live is Christ, to die is gain. He said, I have a desire to depart, it's far better. I'm a straight betwixt two, but he said it's more needful for you. That I mean, listen, the only reason why you are still alive is that somebody needs you. That's all. That's the only reason. Look, if all God saved you for was to take you to heaven, then you should have dropped dead at the altar. Why didn't you? I mean, God didn't save you just as a fire insurance policy from hell, though that's a part of it, but God saved you. For by grace you are saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, is the gift of God, not of works, as any man should boast, for we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works. And the only reason that you aren't, the reason that you didn't drop dead during the night last night, why? Because there's somebody who needs you. That's it. That's the only reason. The only reason you are here. Look, listen to me. It'd be a lot better for all. It'd be a lot better for you, Mr. O'Clair, to go to heaven. But it wouldn't be better for those kids at the grade school. For the system, it'd be a lot better for you if you went to heaven. A lot better for me, too. But it wouldn't be better for those kids in the grade school. Brother Elmer, it'd be a lot better for you to go to heaven. But those muchachos, senoras, and senoritas, and senoras. Need those you. They need you. Brother Moffitt, it'd be a lot better for you to go to heaven. It'd be a lot better for us too. And the bus, but anyhow. But a lot of little kids need you. And Brother Young, he's going to heaven. Brother Bullard, reason. Be a lot better if you. Nothing down here that's better than heaven. There's somebody back there that needs you. And by the way, God didn't leave you here just to eat three square meals a day and have a little fun, make a little money. There's somebody that needs you. That's it. It is more needful for others that you stay or you be gone. And the only reason that God is leaving me in heaven is that you need me. And the only reason you're left is somebody needs you in God's name. Let's get about doing what you're supposed to do for them. Well, I'll be honest with you. I can't comprehend anybody who has somebody that needs them that doesn't want to do his best to fulfill those needs. I'm so sick and tired of slipshod stuff and slipshod things being done. I don't know what to do. I mean, brother, if that school out there needs you, then you do your best and give them what they need. I can't understand it. I can't understand it. Hear ye the master's call. Give me thy best. For be it great or small, that is his test. Do then the best you can. Not for reward, not for the praise of man, but for the Lord. Somebody needs you. You give yourself to being what they need. It's easy to see. My God needs Mrs. Les Smith because she has some little retarded children, educable slow children called the Sunbeams over there she meets with every Sunday. It's easy to see. It's easy to see why God needs Mrs. Houston because she has those pathfinders every Sunday, the educable slow teenagers and adults. It's easy to see why God leaves her here. It's easy to see why God needs Mrs. Denny to stay because she has the blind, and Miss Jeffries because she has the deaf. You may not have quite that obvious a reason, but somebody needs you. There's not a person in this room, let's hear me now, not a person in this room, but what somebody needs you, or you'd be in heaven right now. That's the only reason. It is more needful for some. Look, there's not a one of you, but what wouldn't be better off if you died tonight? I mean that. Better off. Why? No sickness, no sorrow, no sadness, no disease, no heartache, no pain, no cursing, no cancer, no Playboy magazine, no X-rated movies, no filthy television programs, and no dirty magazines, and no cursing, and no profanity, and no lying, and no cheating, and no stealing, and no tuberculosis, and no flu, and no heart attacks, and no blue shoulders, and no furrowed brows, and no wrinkled faces, and no blind eyes, and no deaf ears. I mean, there's a land that is fairer than day, and by faith we can see it afar. Every single person in this house tonight would be better off if you were there now. Well, why aren't you? Well, somebody needs you. Three little illustrations. 22 years we traveled together. For 22 years we stayed in motel rooms beside each other. For 22 years, we sat on platforms together. He preached and I preached, or I preached and he preached. For 22 years, over 2,200 times, we shared the same pulpit together. And then one day I heard that Dr. Rice wasn't well. Dr. Rice had worked for several years on his last project, the Rice Reference Bible. I heard him pray, I guess, 100 times. Oh, God. Oh, God. Let me live long enough to finish the Bible. I'd walk by and see his old weary body in the afternoon, other preachers taking naps. By the way, I never take one. Bill Harvey used to say, I can't sleep at night. I can't sleep at night anymore. Sleep pretty good in the morning and fairly well at night, afternoon, but toss and tumble all night. But Dr. Rice, I'd see him inside his room. I'd walk, take a little walk, and I'd come back, I'd see Dr. Rice, and he'd have his dictaphone machine working on the Rice Reference Bible. Many of you have them in your hand right now. I heard him pray, Dear God, oh Lord, Lord, let me finish the Bible. I remember one day, we're going to church, and Dr. Rice said, here it is. It's finished. And then, that was it. One Wednesday night, my good friend Dr. Bill Rice sat right back here. He had flown up here to have a treatment from Dr. Cal Streeter. He flew up every week, I think it was, and had treatments from him. He had a stroke years before and was paralyzed, and you couldn't understand him talking. He could understand you, but you could hardly understand him. One of the most charming personality I ever knew, Dr. Bill Rice. And one day, he took a nap. He woke up and looked at his wife, Kathy, and he said, Kathy, it's finished. She said, what's finished? Bill, he said, it's finished. She said, what's finished, Bill? He said, it's finished. He laid down to take a nap and woke up in the arms of Christ. Paul said, I've kept the faith. I fought the good fight. I finished the course. Dr. Bill had signed his last sermon to deaf children. He'd ridden his last horse on the cowboy cookout. He'd use that marvelous personality to preach his last message. Could I say this? He got the place to where he wasn't needed. It was more needful that he go to heaven than to stay on earth. You say, when do you want to go, Brother Jack? I want to go when the last hand of hell to comfort has been held. And the last shoulder that God has ordained, my tears to drop on, has been moistened. And the last eyes that have wept in my study have dropped their last tear. the last building that's been built here that God has ordained for me to build. And the last soul that's walked this aisle that God has ordained for me to see saved. And the last spring program or fall program God has ordained. I'm saying, when it's more needful, then I want to go home. Now, the message is this. Somebody needs you. Look all around you. Find someone in need. Help somebody today. Though it be little, a neighborly deed. Help somebody today. My mother went over to her house one day. Started to leave. Mother looked at me and said, "Son, pray that I go on to heaven." It's been, I guess, good night. This has been 15 years ago or more. And I said, "Mother, I'm going to disobey you. I'm not going to pray you go to heaven." She said, "Son," she said, "I'm not doing anybody any good here. I'm just in the way." And I said, "Mama, you're not in the way." Christmas time came. She's in a wheelchair at our house, opening Christmas presents. I went over here to Holiday Inn on North Side and bought 2 weeks, or a week, in the Holiday Inn of gift certificates. And went down to the travel agent, and I got 2 round-trip tickets on Banff Airlines to Dallas, Texas. One for Arlene, one for Mother. Mother opened her Christmas present on Christmas morning. That's what it was. She said, "Son, what is this?" And I said, "You're going to Texas tomorrow." My mother said, I can't go to Texas. I'm too sick. I'm all washed up." And I said, "You're going to Texas tomorrow." She said, "I'd die if I got on an airplane." And I said, "Mama, I got your cemetery lot already paid for in Texas. If you're going to have to go down there, it's a lot more comfortable sitting on those padded seats and being in the luggage compartment in the box." I said, "You're going to get buried in Texas? Fly down there and die! I'll come down and bury you, but don't die up here and get buried in a box. You'll always suffocate down there in that luggage compartment." Ask a question, college students. Ask a question, young ladies. Don't you know why my mama didn't go when she was 80? Because she's needed with somebody. She is needed with somebody. And so are you. Are you helping them? Huh? Our Heavenly Father. It's been a strange message.